Well, I'm going to look at Acts 27 and 28 this morning, and I'd like us to follow Paul and his companions on their journey to Rome and pick up some lessons as we follow him. And the idea that motivated this talk is the idea of the end, the beginning and the end of things. We're meeting here this morning to remember Christ's death and his resurrection. And towards the end of the week, we may get somewhat despondent. We may find the going a little rough. And this is a time of joy, not just of solemnity. So I hope that kind of message will come across here. How do we respond to what we have been given? We meet to remember Jesus' death, and that encourages us to be enthusiastic in the next week. And that's the message, I hope, of this exhortation. So we first meet Paul in chains in Acts 27, bound to a Roman auxiliary. He was a prisoner, among others. This is a situation few of us will face, a curtailment of what it means to have freedom over your own person, a collapse of free will. But we note that the Roman soldier was already treating Paul with kindness and leniency, and this tells us a lot about Paul's attitude. He trusted in God's will over his own, and he accepted his situation. Paul's sense of fairness didn't ask, why me? Instead, Paul thanked God to be counted worthy to suffer for Christ's name. They all set sail for Italy, which from the point of view of the average person living at that time was to the ends of the earth, many living out their entire lives in a single village or town. And after changing ships for a much heavier and larger and deeper vessel, and a lot of hard work striving against the adverse weather, they were forced to change course and eventually struggled to make port in Crete, well behind schedule, by the skin of their teeth, as it were. If you've ever been caught in a yacht sailing against rapid tides and freezing wind, making no headway and looking around for danger that you can scarce avoid, you'll know what they were going through. They just had survived. And Paul warned of coming disaster if they set sail again. But he was ignored, and the centurion in majority didn't follow his advice because the harbour would have been too risky to overwinter in. The winter winds in that harbour could have driven in. The ship may have broken loose, it may have damaged the dock. And just as today, the owners of the dock would have forced them to leave early if that were the case. So this very uncomfortable stay in a ship, in a cold and drafty ship in an uncomfortable harbour, was decided to be a bad idea. And this grain ship, which was after all a trading vessel, was not seen to be something. They didn't want to lose the grain in part payment for damages to the dock. And the owner of the vessel wanted to move on against Paul's advice. So they looked for a chance to go against Paul's advice. And they, in the end, decided to make a risky run across the coast. This would have been a very easy sail in the summer, but we know from historical sources an extremely dangerous one at this time of year, late September, early October. And their apprehension lifted when they saw this gentle south wind, so inviting, and they shoved off. Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also. So a stern warning. And now comes this wind called a nor'easter, a great severity, against which they were utterly helpless. And this was an infamous katabatic wind, a wind that forces its way down under gravity from the mountain ranges, gathering speed as it does so, and it comes through the valleys. And if it catches a ship, it's like a matchbox. And this great wind propelled the bow of this large ship straight through the climbing waves southwards under the island of Gouda. And as these waves grew in ferocity and the ship was tossed about and the wind held and the danger increased, one can only imagine the desperation of these prisoners, still probably in their chains below deck, their lives completely under the control of professional soldiers, having no freedom to escape, expecting perhaps to be submerged with the ship. If they were lucky, they might be killed by the soldiers before going down. But if they weren't lucky, in that part of the Mediterranean, the ship would drift further south into the hundreds of miles of boggy marshlands near Libya. And then this deep ship would be unable to navigate the shallow channels, and they would wait for the storm to subside, the sun would come out, the ship would heat up, and they would have no water. And they would die languishing, slowly of dehydration, perhaps still chained. So these were the thoughts going through those on that boat, the sailors and the travellers there, and they gave up hope. But it's now in this bleakness and this hunger due to seasickness, this helplessness and suffering, that the angel of God gives his message of hope. Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. Keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island. A message of confidence during their trial when there is no sign of rescue. It's an interesting aside that the wisdom of the modern world associates suffering with God's powerlessness or unwillingness to help. Not with his plan to have you turn to him and be saved. So here was a moment of decision for those listening to Paul. Would they believe or would they believe not? Well, they took soundings and realizing they were about to run aground at night in completely unfamiliar territory, they commanded that four anchors were thrown overboard from the rear of the ship. And there's some evidence to suggest these anchors weighed about 450 pounds, about 200 kilograms each. No small feat. So while that was being attempted, the sailors were at the other end attempting to escape. And if ever there were a time for a lifeboat, an escape attempt, this was it, wasn't it? But it was only by faith that they would be saved. The way of life, as it were, that they saw was barred. Paul spoke to the soldiers again. Unless they remain, we cannot be saved. And so the soldiers cut loose that lifeboat and watched it drift away. Whoever tries to keep his life will lose it, we're told. And whoever loses his life will preserve it. So imagine there in the pitch black, with no lifeboat, unstable ground, no way of escape, the bow of the ship turns to face the relentless wind and these enormous swelling waves. And this ship was rolling and creaking and coming apart. And they prayed that they would live to see daylight. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day. You have been in suspense and have gone without food. You've eaten nothing. I urge you to take some food, for this is important for your survival. Not one of you will lose a hair from his head." And notice those words, taking food, important for your survival. Your hairs are numbered. We're seeing some echoes here. And after this, Paul took bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all and broke it and began to eat. And they were all encouraged. And as the light returned, they ate their fill and cast the remainder of the food into the sea, looking out through the rain towards land. They untied the anchor ropes and watched them drift away, and hoisting the sail, they drove towards the shore. And as the ship gathered speed and mounted up on these huge breaking waves, God deprived them of this easy landing. They were, after all, aiming for a sandy beach, an easy way of stepping off this breaking boat. And still out at sea, the ship's bow got stuck in the sandbars. The rear of the ship was repeatedly smashed and it began to be torn apart. And we remember the centurion prevented the killing of Paul and the others and ordered that those who could swim should swim and others would just be hanging on to parts of this broken boat. So what's going on here, brothers and sisters? Why did God deliberately drive them off course and shipwreck them in this way? Why did he prevent the ship from reaching shore? Why was it necessary that they went through this together? We know that God is in control. We don't doubt that. And yet the ship was smashed to pieces. With these prisoners and these guards and these sailors and travellers, some 276 people started their journey as sinners. Some on their way to trial in chains, businessmen and sailors, all initially ignoring this unknown prisoner's advice. All these fellows trusted in a ship that couldn't save them. They were all slaves, as it were, to ultimate shipwreck. And yet, through the quiet resignation and acceptance of one man, and the prayers and example of him and his companions, and his spiritual peace and presence of mind in these extreme circumstances, God was pouring out his grace on these undeserving people. And Paul gave thanks and broke bread in front of them, and they gained encouragement. Faith in Paul's tenacious trust in God. And they were looking towards him, weren't they, for leadership. And they consequently washed up on shore, as it were, saved through water. So we imagine these stunned men looking back at the place where the ship had been, where they had trusted in, now in pieces around them. We imagine them grouping together and gathering on the beach. No longer were they all equal, fighting their fears and the elements to stay alive. Now they were away from the danger. Now they were being forced to step back into their old lives, whether they were slaves or prisoners, businessmen or sailors. Some knew they were guilty. Others had clear consciences. The owner of the ship has lost his livelihood, and the traders their cargo. So what use was all this confidence they'd previously had, and what would their next steps be? And we see on this shoreline a transition period for these people. But one thing we know about them, that none of them were any longer in chains. One thing we know about their self-confidence, that this Paul, before nobody, had become to each of these men someone to watch intently and to look up to. This man that had saved them all had all the answers when they had none. What would he now do? Who is this man? So the islanders who noticed the ship moored out to sea in the early darkness had seen the whole disaster unfold in front of them. They prepared a fire, and they were now welcoming these total strangers. 276 wet, hungry strangers. And as I walked past the memorial just now, it occurred to me, what would happen if there was a big rainstorm and they all came in here, looking at the sign outside and expecting a warm welcome, and interrupted our gathering here as we remember Jesus? We would have a decision to make, wouldn't we? And I suppose it would make Jesus very happy were we to stop the meeting and to welcome them, and it would be a great opportunity for us to preach the truth by our actions. And here was exactly the same opportunity, but in reverse. We see the humbling hand of God resting on these shipwrecked souls at their lowest ebb, having lost everything. With grateful hearts at merely being alive, they were now experiencing that humbling kindness of strangers. And we see them in our mind's eye, sheltering together from the rain. Each one of these 276 people had a story to share with the locals. The locals' heads would turn, as it were, to Paul, wouldn't they, on hearing this story. He would have intrigued them, a man starting off as a prisoner, as far as they all knew, who had done these things, some kind of criminal, a mystery there. But Paul was busy. Paul was picking up sticks for the fire and throwing them on. A snake sprung out and attached himself to his hand. It's a fitting metaphor, isn't it? He was picking up sticks to bring warmth to others. He was about, as it were, the truth's business. And a viper sprung out and bit him. In any case, as we remember earlier, the wisdom of this world associates suffering with God's powerlessness or unwillingness or judgment. And so we read, the islanders said, this man must be a murderer, for though he escaped from the sea, the goddess Justice hasn't allowed him to live. Nowadays, people believe in this sort of cosmic justice, of karma, don't they? Because I suppose they believe they're one step better than believing in a in a goddess with a personality. It's okay to believe in things as long as they don't have personalities, as abstract gods. So at the moment when Paul was working to warm those fledgling believers around him who'd been experiencing his spiritual side, they were still so very different from him. These islanders revealed that they were completely lost in paganism. They saw him as a murderer. Do we doubt that at that moment, Paul's companions prayed for the islanders? How lost they were. How confident they were in myths and not in God's transformative spirit. And as they slandered Paul, we take a moment to remember David and Shimei, don't we? We remember how David, when Shimei attacked him, allowed that attack as if it were from God. And we remember how heavy Paul's heart was about his past life. We read in Acts, "Meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus, so he found anyone belonging to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners." And we read, "And that's just what I did in Jerusalem. On the authority of the chief priest, I put many of the Lord's people in prison, and when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. Many a time I went from one synagogue to another to have them punished, and I tried to force them to blaspheme. I was so obsessed with persecuting them that I even hunted them down in foreign cities." So says Paul. So these slanderous accusations against Paul would have hurt. But as Paul shook off the snake, his prayer was of thanks for his calling. That he of all people had been given the chance to share in the glory of God. And he shook off the viper in disgust, as if such a thing as his guilt, or such a thing as this viper, could stand against the purpose of God. He knew that despite his past, he was called, he had been told he would stand in Rome. He knew he wasn't his own man. It wasn't about his will. The reason why that viper was there, the reason why all the suffering was there in his life, was to show the Lord's power in his life. In Romans 9, we read that of Pharaoh, that I raised you up for this very purpose, that I might display my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. And Paul, the forgiven man, shook off his past with that snake and waited, knowing all eyes were on him. He waited, watching, as it were, in those moments, the display of the Lord's power in him, waiting for these people to make their determination. And that list of witnesses, with those experiences of Paul's spiritual attitude, and with a first-hand story to tell, was growing. But blown around by all the unstable wind of pagan doctrine, they decided, therefore, he must be a god. And brothers and sisters, we have no doubt that he wasted no time in putting them straight and teaching them of the true God. But nonetheless, many had seen a man unharmed by the bite of a viper that was seen to be hanging off his hand. This is news. And together with the stories from the ship, it would have lit up the island. We're not sure from the record, but I think we can safely surmise that the islands ushered him in to see the ruler. And this is one of my favourite proofs, as it were, of Luke's accuracy, that of all of the titles of the Roman governors, proconsuls and tetrarchs and politarchs and so on, this man was called the chief man of the island, or in Greek, protos, or primus in Latin, the first man of the island. And this was a fact ridiculed by many historians until they dug up Latin and Greek inscriptions bearing this technical title of this man, Protus, first man of the island, which is a nice little snippet of Bible truth, isn't it? Now Paul, with the prayer and laying on of his hands, he heals Publius's father, who perhaps had malarial dysentery. And this is another turning point in Paul's ministry on that island. The islanders came from every quarter to be healed. We remember him scarcely able to prevent the crowd from worshipping him when they thought he was Mercury. And here, Paul spends 3 months with these islanders. So we can, as it were, really appreciate how much they would have held him in high esteem and how that high esteem would have enabled him to preach the truth and to build up this church in Malta. And we don't doubt to encourage the faith of those who had been with him on that ship. Imagine the long meetings and preaching sessions that Paul would have led on that island. Paul and his companions with him teaching. These people, after all, on that island were not Christian Jews. They were pagans with no grounding at all in Scripture. And that three-month period was a design from God to bring those people into Christ's body. So we see here God's foresight in providing Luke and his other companions to carry out the work of teaching these people from scratch. We see how God guided the ship, and we see how he guided the minds of the people and engineered the entire thing from the beginning. So when they were leaving, the Maltese people provided everything they needed. And intriguingly, this reminds us of the Egyptian generosity when God's witnesses left Egypt. So they've all overwintered in Malta for 3 months, from perhaps the middle of October now to the middle of January. While the weather is still cold, the winds have died down. These winds of false doctrine, as it were. And what was impossible now becomes possible. They are now able to travel to Italy unimpeded. And God, having completed his work through Paul in Malta, sped the ship onwards towards Italy, and their journey was straightforward, aided by a south wind. So we next meet Paul at Puteoli. We read, "There we found some brothers and sisters who invited us to spend a week with them." And I note that Paul finds them. We imagine Paul, in his usual way, probably went straight to inquire of where his own people were, in order to make contact with them and encourage them and preach the truth to them. Now, after a week spent encouraging them with the indulgence of the centurion, Paul was on his way again to Rome. And the brothers and sisters there had heard that we were coming, and they travelled as far as the Forum of Appius and the three taverns to meet us. And at the sight of these people, Paul thanked God and was encouraged. The Appian Way was hard going, and Paul was, by all accounts in early history, a man of small stature. We have here, from the poet Horace, a small cameo of what Paul experienced in this place where he met the brothers and sisters. We read in the satires that Appii Forum was crammed with boatmen and stingy tavern keepers. "Here, owing to the water, for it was villainous, I declared war against my stomach and waited impatiently while my companions dined." Horace writes that night was beginning to draw her curtain over the earth, and that the stars were being sprinkled in the sky, and slaves were railing at boatmen, and boatmen were railing at slaves, all of them getting drunk. There were cursed mosquitoes and frogs driving away the sleep. This was not an easy place to be, not an easy journey by any stretch. We imagine Paul's relief and happiness at seeing these brothers and sisters on their way who'd heard he was coming. What things they must have heard. And they would bring with them support, local knowledge, spiritual conversation and companionship on this road back to Rome. And 3 days later, Paul would be at the synagogue, speaking with his Jewish fellows. "My brothers, although I have done nothing against our people or against the customs of our ancestors, I was arrested in Jerusalem and handed over to the Romans, who examined me and wanted to release me because I wasn't guilty of any crime deserving death. The Jews objected, so I was compelled to make an appeal to Caesar. I didn't intend to bring any charge against my own people. For this reason I have asked to see you and talk with you. Because of the hope of Israel, I am bound with this chain." They replied, "We haven't received any letters from Judea concerning you, and none of our people who've come from there have reported or said anything bad about you. But we want to hear what your views are, for we know that people everywhere are speaking against this sect." All the documents that the Jewish leaders and the letters that they perhaps would have sent would have come with Paul on his boat. These denouncements of him, these accusations of blasphemy and of heresy would have been destroyed in his shipwreck. After all, had this not been one of the last, if not the last, boat to leave before conditions grew too dangerous to sail? Any further boats leaving wouldn't have carried any letters. They would have assumed they had reached Rome, would have reached Italy. So can we say it was because of the shipwreck that the Jews had been given the chance to accept the truth, unpolluted by lies? So even in their most dire and difficult circumstances, here we see again perhaps the foreknowledge and the wisdom and love of God is working for the good for those who would accept him. As we read, where are your accusers? Well, his accusers had no case, and they weren't present, and neither were their letters. Paul was allowed, therefore, 3 years to preach the truth and build the church unobstructed, something we can't even dream of in today's supposedly free society. The Maltese church and the Roman church would have survived into future generations based on the stories and the first-hand eyewitness accounts of the incredible things, the incredible faith and constancy of Paul. So we see this man, this tremendous man, preaching wherever he could, in prison, in chains, on boats, in foreign lands, in households and synagogues. We see him preaching in love, without an accusation even against his nation that was attempting to have him killed. He used Bible authority, was able to preach to those pagans who knew nothing and encourage them into learning the truth, all from the law and the prophets, we read in verse 23. And he preached the gospel and the king and about the kingdom and the Lord Jesus, again verse 31 and 23. He preached as soon as he could. After a long journey, he was instantly witnessing, instantly about his work, instantly finding brothers and sisters or companions or fellows or possible people that would listen. After 3 days, we read he was in the synagogue, and he preached always. He was tireless and tenacious, and he led sessions from morning until night, and he was bold. He preached to Jews, he preached to Gentiles, anyone close enough to hear. Seeing this response of Paul to his calling, despite the recognition of his failure, is a humbling experience, is it not? And also, as it were, understanding the context that God was working so closely with him, arranging his suffering and the suffering of those around him to bring those who came into contact with him, to entrain those people, as it were, in his wake, to bring them into the truth. Again, it brings us to today and our own response. And I would like to read just a verse or two from the 1st of Corinthians 4. Now it's required that those who've been given a trust must prove faithful. I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. I don't even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that doesn't make me innocent. It's the Lord that judges me. Therefore, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait until the Lord comes. And he writes a few verses later, I urge you to imitate me. It's a high bar, is it not? Paul's example is of total focus and total commitment as the answer to his calling. And we're encouraged by Paul's suffering not to consider our own suffering as pointless or evidence for an absence of God or for an early judgment, but that in our trials we should have faith in a purposeful and powerful love of God that passes our understanding. We should have peace of mind that comes from this, like Paul. And with love, wherever we are, using the Bible as an authority, be bold and hold tirelessly and tenaciously to the truth, preaching the gospel to those who are near and showing them our example. So as we meet now to remember that one in whom the fullness of deity was held bodily, just think about not only what he has done for us, the tremendous purposeful suffering that Jesus went through, which is very solemn, but to also remember that our response is to remember this joyous resurrection that he's made possible, and in this next week, to imitate Paul in his total commitment to the truth.